Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and it's a day devoted to politics. Election Day is tomorrow. Early voting, satellite voting, is available only at the auditor's office today on Monday, and most of Story County will be going to their polling places tomorrow. At the end of the hour, I speak with a candidate who is outside the mainstream, Democrats and Republicans. He is the Iowa Party candidate for Governor Jonathan Narcisse, a Des Moines businessman and advocate for African Americans in the state and in the Des Moines School District. That's at the end of the hour. But now we turn to my interview with Jim Maurer, candidate for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa. Jim's staffer called me up Wednesday night last week saying his schedule had opened up and he would be available for an interview the next day. I contacted the Steve King campaign. However, he could not make time for us here at KHOI. We regret not being able to air both sides in this race. So, without further ado, here is my interview with Jim Maurer, Democratic challenger for the seat of U.S. Congress from Iowa's 4th District. Jim, you are asking to represent the 4th District. The idea of representation is rather interesting. Obviously, we are a diverse constituency. As you travel around the district and talk to people face-to-face, what do you see in the people's faces, lives, and perspectives that you say, yes, that is what I represent?
Well, the same values, the Iowa values that I hold, are the same values that I see throughout the 4th District and the 39 counties that make up the 4th District. I grew up on a farm in Boone County, right next door. And so my values are, you know, respect, hard work, selfless service. And so that's what I see throughout the 4th District. People are very concerned about our future. The one thing that I hear the most from Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike is that they're very disappointed with what's coming out of Washington right now. They're disappointed in many instances with the president. They're disappointed with Congress. They're disappointed with Congressman King. And so there's some pessimism there. And, I don't like to see that. But what I do see is everything the thing that is right with this country here in the 4th District, which is that that people are working hard for the future. They're investing in the future. And that's the type of values that I would bring to Congress, is I believe that this country is the greatest nation on earth because we've been willing to invest in it. We've been willing to work hard. When the greatest generation came home from war, they invested in our roads and our bridges and our schools. They invested in research and development. They put a man on the moon. And that's the positive agenda that we need to bring forward. And I think that's a contrast in this race between the ideology of my opponent and I, is I want to continue to invest in the future of this country and ensure that we remain the greatest nation on earth. And frankly, I believe that Congressman King, my opponent, believes that we need to stop, that we need to pull back, that we need to stop investing in the future. And I think that's just a clear choice that the voters have.
The most prominent part of your resume, of course, is your military service in Iraq with the Iowa National Guard, and later your work at the Pentagon, finding places to tighten the military budget. I'm sure the people of Central Iowa would like to hear a little more about your views related to those circumstances. You say that you were motivated by 9/11 to enlist in the military. In retrospect, please share your views on what the invasion of Iraq meant.
Sure. Well, I think, we obviously can't go back and relitigate everything that's occurred over the past decade. I think there's a lot of reasons to believe that that wasn't the right move. I've said that publicly. That being said, I'm proud of my service. I believe I wanted to take personal responsibility for the future of our country. It was nine of the attacks of September 11th that motivated me and a lot of other young Americans of every stripe to serve in different capacities. I'm proud of what I've done. I think we need to continue to be focused on the future. I think there is a good case to say that, if the investment in blood and treasure and instability in the Middle East, that We should have stayed focused on Afghanistan rather than going into Iraq, but we need to be focused on the future. We have a growing regional threat in ISIS now, and we need to stop it from spreading to become a global threat, becoming a threat to the American homeland. And so it needs to be confronted in a limited military way. It needs to be confronted with a full diplomatic offensive with our allies throughout the world and in the region. And right now we have a broad coalition. We have, for example, another Sunni nation in Saudi Arabia that's carrying out military operations against a Sunni terrorist group. And so it can't be seen as the United States versus, ISIS. It needs to be a broad international coalition. I think we're on the right track here. One area where I have strong disagreement with the president and Congressman King is that they both want to arm the Sunni rebels in Syria. And I have publicly said that many of these groups that claim to be the more moderate rebels are the same groups that I was fighting with the Iowa National Guard in western Iraq near the Syrian border when I was there. And so arming these groups is not the right approach. The CIA has recently produced a report that's saying arming groups like this has in the past and likely in the future will not be the right approach either. And I don't think we should be arming people who, frankly, are responsible for the death of American troops in Iraq.
Okay, well, that was a lot for people to digest. Let's go back a little bit. The Sunni terrorist group would be ISIS, and that you referred to in relation to Saudi Arabia. It's very complicated, and yet when you say Sunni rebel groups, are you talking about
I know it's complex.
I know the
absolutely.
Kurds are against the Sunni, against ISIS. The Kurds are on the front line against ISIS.
Right.
And so I was going to ask you about arming the Kurds. Can you explain, just educate us
absolutely.
A little bit?
So that's the right approach because this is a complex situation. I've spent years on the ground in Iraq as a soldier and as a civilian doing intelligence work. So I have a pretty broad and deep understanding of this, and I know that it's very complicated. So within Iraq, for example, you have three distinct groups. You have the Shia Muslims, the Sunni Muslim, and you have the Kurds in northern Iraq. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. He had power, even though that the Sunnis were the minority population. After 2003, with more of a more representative government, the Shia majority took power. And so there's been this divide between the Shia and the Sunni, and frankly, the Kurds in the north haven't wanted to have a lot to do with the rest of them regardless. And so you had a governance problem in Iraq. That's why the security state broke down, what we're seeing now. You had Prime Minister Maliki, who was a Shia, who frankly was working with the Iranians as well. And you had the Sunnis separate, and that's why the ISIS has had some traction. The Sunnis essentially walked away from the government because Prime Minister Maliki and the Shia walked away from the Sunnis. And so the Kurds in the north right now are fighting ISIS. The problem with arming the Kurds, and again, I don't disagree that that's arming the Kurds is probably a good approach to fighting ISIS. However, that being said, again, because this whole situation has to be overly complicated, unfortunately, our NATO ally in Turkey has a lot of problems with the Kurds. And so this is a topic that came up in Congressman King and I's debate last Thursday, is that he said, well, we need to arm the Kurds. And I said, well, that may be true, and I don't disagree. The Kurds are fighting ISIS, and I think we probably do want to arm the Kurds, absolutely. That being said, we have to work through the complexity that we have our NATO ally in Turkey, who is in some instances actively carrying out attacks against those same Kurdish fighters. So again, this goes back to the fact that this is a complicated situation. We need to approach it as such, and we need people who understand these complexities as we move forward. And I think there's not enough of that.
And the Kurds are in the north of Iraq, and that is the part that borders the eastern part of Syria. So this all – there's some fluidity of that border?
Oh, absolutely. I mean the border is at this point just a line on a map. There's you have a very porous border there that exists, and it always has been, frankly, to a certain degree. I was near and on the Syrian border in 2006 and 2007 in Iraq, and at that point you had Sunni fighters and lethal aid coming across that border as well. But now in that area, it's known as Kurdistan. And that flows from Iraq into Syria and up into Turkey as well.
You served in Iraq under both Presidents Bush and Obama, first as soldier and then as military analyst. Steve King has criticized the staged withdrawal from Iraq and blamed this for the rise of ISIS. Can you share your thoughts on that line of argument?
Well, it's a false premise, because what Congressman King is saying is that we should have left more forces in Iraq. However, at the time when the Status of Forces Agreement was being negotiated, we had a prime minister, Prime Minister Maliki, who wasn't willing to sign a Status of Forces Agreement that was reasonable and met the criteria that the United States needed. For example, Prime Minister Maliki insisted that any American troops left in Iraq should be subject to Iraqi law. That's not something that the United States was willing to, and as you might imagine, there would be a lot of very, very negative consequences of that. So that's not something we were willing to do. And so, it would have been better to negotiate a Status of Forces agreement that I think would have provided some additional assistance that hopefully would have provided for a better security situation, although with the governance, with the government of Iraq essentially not functioning, it's hard to see, you know, that happening in a way that would have been, very helpful. But we essentially had an Iraqi prime minister who wasn't willing to negotiate in good faith to have American troops in Iraq. So at that point, to be critical of those negotiations, and I was on the ground in Iraq at that time in 2009, and these negotiations broke down. They weren't going well. And so I agree. It would have been good to have a Status of Forces agreement that kept American troops, a limited number of advisors and strategically placed assets, but that wasn't an option. And so when Congressman King says, oh, we should have done this, well, that wasn't an option at the time. That's what the facts speak to.
That wasn't an option because then we would be breaking the promise to the American people that we would withdraw. We would be breaking the promise to the Iraqis that we would withdraw. Why was it not an option?
Well, again, the Iraqi government had to agree to the criteria of which American troops would stay there. And so I think leaving, a limited number of assets, non-combat forces, advisors, et cetera, would have been something that was feasible, and I don't think it would have been a broken promise, because they would have been there to essentially help the Iraqi security forces take responsibility for themselves and the Iraqi government. But that just wasn't an option, because the Iraqis they wanted American forces gone, and that's something we had to deal with at the time.
Let's move to the military budget, because you've spent a lot of time working on that at the Pentagon. What can you explain what you did in your role there?
Absolutely. So when I came into the Pentagon in the very beginning of January in 2010, my title was a very ambiguous one, as Special Assistant to the Undersecretary of the Army, and which could frankly mean about anything. And so what I really did is I had a couple different roles. I was the Army's lead representative to the Council of Governors. So I worked with the 54 state and territory governors on Army National Guard issues. And my main focus was being tasked by the Undersecretary of the Army, who is also the Chief Management of the Officer of the Army, the CMO, tasked me with overseeing the establishment of the Army Office of Business Transformation. And this was a congressionally mandated office to be stood up, to reexamine the Army's business operations after a decade of war. And so what I did with that office is go through the Army's operations, acquisition, IT, logistics, and work with the defense industry and the generals and the House and Senate Armed Services Committees and reform the governance and processes behind those things. And so what we did is take industry best practices in those areas and reform a lot of those things that were happening in the Pentagon. And there were a lot of things that were not being done efficiently. And so we fixed those things, and without cutting any services, saved about $3.5 billion through the reforms put into place while I was there. And the most recent report to Congress that came out of the Army Office of Business Transformation now shows that those initial reforms that were put into place are producing about $4 billion a year in savings.
Can you explain in somewhat more detail, paint a picture of what not doing things efficiently means?
Sure.
And how that was changed?
Well, the Army is about $140 billion a year operation. So you might imagine with a million-person Army, with a million soldiers and a lot of moving parts throughout the United States and all over the world, there's a lot of things that meet the criteria of a business operation. And so acquisition, for example, the Army is going to go out and buy, you know, something as simple as socks for a million soldiers. That's a pretty large acquisition. And so there were processes in place, for example, where some of these things were not being done in a strategic way that makes sense. And so maybe socks weren't the best example, but if you look at computers, for example, we had base commanders, for example, who had their own budget to go out and buy a couple hundred computers, for example. Well, when we looked at that process, we said, well, that's not how the private sector does it. You don't have, you know, individual commanders going out and buying their own things. So what we did is say we brought those operations up to the strategic macro level and said we can negotiate these costs, and if we buy, you know, 100,000 computers versus buying 200 computers, you're going to get a discount on that bulk. I mean, you can negotiate a bulk rate essentially. And so those are the types of things that we changed, you know, the process that existed, the decision-making structure that was behind those things. And so a lot of it did have to do with IT, for example, because a lot of companies in the private sector have come up this way as well because, you know, IT kind of started seeping into business operations in the 80s and 90s and have changed dramatically. And so you've kind of strung those things along, and it wasn't done at the very beginning in a way that made a whole lot of sense across the board. And so you've kind of come to this point, you know, buying something new this year and buying something new, and then you figure out a way to link them together and make them talk to each other. And we had a bunch of, you know, databases that we would patch together, and this would talk to that. And then, you know, for example, we would pay a private contractor, you know, a couple hundred thousand or a couple million dollars a year to maintain that transfer of data and that patch that existed, that specially bought system that existed. And so what we moved to was a more, you know, strategic approach, something where there was a more uniform standard. And we tried to buy as much commercial off the shelf as we could as well, things that existed. Because too many times, you know, the way the Army processes came about is there were a special problem, and we went out and we found a business to create a software to address this specific problem. And so that costs a lot of money when you have something, you know, specifically built for you and specifically maintained for you. And so we moved to a more any area that we could, and not all areas are applicable, obviously. Private companies don't maintain intelligence databases the same way the military might, for example. But in logistics, for example, when we're tracking soldiers, when we're tracking equipment and all these other things, a lot of private companies track things in that same way. And so we moved to change the, you know, acquisition and maintenance approaches of how we did those things. And by moving to that kind of cost-conscious culture of our leaders, that's how we started moving in the right direction. And knowing, and this is where, you know, someone like Secretary Gates was a leader, knowing that the military, you know, we'd had these huge budgets, these huge defense budgets during the post-9/11 era, and during the conflicts. And knowing that that was probably going to be coming to an end, which it has. It has shrunk, and with sequestration, you have an even larger across-the-board cut. Knowing that we need to use our dollars more wisely. And so as Secretary Gates phrased it, moving money from tail to tooth. Because every dollar we spend on, you know, logistics or, you know, a computer system here in the United States, that's not money that we don't have to go out and buy things that the soldiers on the ground need at the tip of the spear, which it means, you know, new equipment or training.
Okay. In your view, what is the relationship between business and the military? I mean, the husband of Mamie Eisenhower once talked about the military-industrial complex as a threat to American democracy. Can you talk about the relationship between business and military?
Well, I appreciate the Mamie Eisenhower reference. As some may not know, Mamie Eisenhower is from Boone, Iowa, my hometown. And so in Boone, President Eisenhower probably is referred to as the husband of Mamie Eisenhower. But look, as many have pointed out, number one, the national defense is a priority. I mean, that is an area of that we agree is a role of the federal government. It's something that's important to every American. We need to have a strong national defense. However, every dollar we spend on national defense is a dollar that we're not spending on something else. And that's something that President Eisenhower pointed out as well. Instead of building a new bridge or a new road or a new school or investing in research of diseases, we're spending that on military equipment. And, you know, in a perfect world, you wouldn't have to do that. But that's not the case. And so I think the military-industrial complex, we have a defense industry that exists to equip the military, the military contracts with many of these private companies to produce equipment and weapon systems. And that's something that's needed, but it's something that, you know, as we decide on the scale and scope of that investment and what exactly our national defense should be focused on, we have to be realistic about what our cost constraints are and what the best investments are for the future. I think too many times we're focused on fighting wars of the past, and that's something that a lot of military leaders have pointed out as well, is what's the emerging threat? What is the next conflict going to look like? And so I've spent a lot of time talking about the emerging threat that is cybersecurity, and that's an area we need to be investing in. If you look at asymmetric warfare, which is, again, non-traditional warfare, that's something that we need to be focused on. We need to be focused on a pivot to Asia as those threats emerge in the future. And so too many times we're focused on fighting, being aligned to fight the Cold War, for example. The Abrams tank, for example, is something that military leaders, that the generals have said, we don't need this weapon system anymore. This is not the weapon system that we need to fight the wars of the future. Yet Congress continues to insist that they produce it. That Congress gives them money and directs the Pentagon to, I think it's over $400 million a year to maintain and invest in this weapon system that the generals are saying we don't want or need. And so there's special interest, there's parochial interest that exists there. And so as we move forward, we need to make those common sense reforms to be investing in the future.
Part of the future warfare, as we've come to understand it, includes drones, either for military or surveillance purposes. And many people are uncomfortable with this notion of drones, and especially the idea that they will be controlled here in Des Moines. What do you know about the control center in Des Moines, and what do you advocate in terms of the development of drone warfare?
Well, I can't really speak specifically to Des Moines. And so what I can say is I view that as another weapon system. Now, you can debate what that means, but it's obviously a good thing that in many cases we aren't putting American service members' lives directly at risk, that we can do something like that remotely. And so it's an emerging technology. It's an emerging potential battle space, drone versus drone, all these other things. But to be realistic, it's something that is going to be part of the battlefield in the future. And we need to be, I think we need to be careful, obviously, when we look at how, we're talking about this. Originally a lot of the drone program was not discussed in public. It was done secretly. And so as I think we move into the future, there needs to be more clear communication and there needs to be a more clear governance behind some of these drone strikes. If you look at, right now you have the CIA carrying out drone strikes. They're done in secret. And so what is the process in which those strikes are approved? Who's carrying out those strikes? So I think there needs to be more clarity. There needs to be more understanding. I think that Congress should weigh in and say this is the way that this, the governance behind these things. So who's carrying out these strikes? What's the approval authority? Are they being done in areas that are not designated combat zones, et cetera? So I think there just needs to be more communication. There needs to be more understanding of what, what we're doing with drones.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and we're listening to an interview of congressional candidate Jim Maurer, which I conducted last Thursday. We moved on from foreign policy issues into domestic affairs. You said that you support the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yes.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, I think if you look at the Keystone Pipeline, I've looked at this and I've heard a lot of people concerned on both sides of it. I looked at the State Department's environmental impact study. I look at where we're at, and I think that we have to accept that in the short term we do rely on fossil fuels. That being said, we need to take this opportunity to look at the mid and long-term energy strategy that we have in this country, which, frankly, we don't have a real clear vision and investment strategy for the future. So I think as we move forward on this particular front, we need to make increased investments and decisions to invest in clean, renewable energy for the future.
Your opponent does not hold much truck with climate change science. How about you?
Well, that is definitely a clear contrast in this race. As Congressman King has said, that climate change does not exist, and that if it does exist, it might be a good thing, as he has said. And I completely disagree. I think there is clear scientific quantitative evidence to show that climate change does exist, that humans contribute significantly to that, and that it's an existential threat to our future. And here in Iowa, we have the most to gain by being proactive, and we are being proactive about it. Our agricultural economy and our clean renewable energy front, the fact that we get 30% of our electricity and wind in Iowa from wind. So we have the most to gain. And then we also have the most to lose by not being proactive. If you look at the projections, our agricultural economy will suffer significantly if we're not proactive in confronting climate change.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I think just again, if we feed the country and the world here in Iowa. You know, the agriculture, our agricultural economy is not only important to our local and state economy; it's important to the world. And so, if we're not proactive on this front, Congressman King, for example, is successful in saying we shouldn't do anything, we're going to be put on a course that is very dangerous for the future of our agricultural economy. It's very dangerous for the future of our country and the world. And that's why planners at the Pentagon, for example, have put into their planning processes for the future the effects of climate change and what that does to our national security and what that does to evoke conflicts around the world. And so even our defense planners understand that this is an existential threat on many fronts and that we need to be doing something to stop it.
Okay. So while you have characterized Steve King as a fearmonger, this is one area in which you believe the threat is real and we should be concerned.
Well, the science is in. And, look, there's quantitative evidence and fact to point to that this is something that we need to face. Now, we need to face it in a calm way. We need to be deliberate about it. The fear-mongering that my opponent, Congressman King, carries out, his last TV ad, for example, talked about that, members of ISIS and Ebola are coming across our southern border, which there is zero evidence to back that up. It is fear-mongering. It's not based in any quantitative fact or reason. And so he literally is trying to make people afraid, and that's his means of gaining support.
Before you leave, we have to ask you about the Affordable Care Act, as repealing that law has become one of the cornerstones of your opponent's campaign. In your debate last week, you stated there were parts of Obamacare that you had serious issues with, but overall it was worth keeping and reforming. Am I right in that characterization?
Well, as I did say in the debate, I've got a lot of problems with the Affordable Care Act. If you look at the physician relicensing requirements, you look at some of the funding mechanisms and taxes on insurance plans, I think there's a lot of fixes that needs to happen. But we need to keep moving forward. People like David Young, who's the Republican nominee in the 3rd District, has said he accepts the fact that, the Affordable Care Act is the policy we have in place now. We need people who want to work to make our healthcare system works. And there are a lot of things that we can't go backwards on. And that's what Congressman King has voted time and time again to do. He's voted to take away coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. He's voted to allow insurance companies to charge women more than men. He's voted to not allow parents to keep their children on their insurance until 26. And so these are areas where we can't go backwards on. We need to keep moving forward. We need to make our healthcare system work. And, you know, we need policymakers who can do that, who aren't stuck on this idea that we need to go back to the way things were. And so that's, I think, the clear choice that voters have.
All right. I think we're down to the end here. Is there any topic that we haven't brought up yet that you would like to comment on?
Well, you know, the last question, the debate last week was, what do you want to focus on? What's the first thing you do when you go to Congress? And Congressman King didn't really answer that question. I had a very clear answer, which is I want to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 as Senator Harkin has proposed. That would give 300,000 working Iowans a pay raise. I believe there's dignity in work, and if you work 40 hours a week in this country, you should not live in poverty. And so that is a clear move. It is something that we can and should do on day one that will help working families all over Iowa and all over the country.
You also mentioned infrastructure. Is that one area that you'd like to see the government get involved?
Absolutely. And that is something, you know, when I talk about investing in the future, investing in our infrastructure has always proven to be a great investment. And right now we're not doing enough of that. We have, you know, the 38th most efficient bridges in the country here in Iowa. And so I support a broad infrastructure bill. There's a bill specifically in the House right now that I support. It has 30 Republican co-sponsors and 30 Democratic co-sponsors. These are the types of things we need to be doing to invest in the future of this country, to make sure that the rural economy is strong, to make sure that we're competitive in the global economy for the future.
So you're a young person.
I guess relatively so.
How old are you?
I'm 28.
Many people your age are very disillusioned with politics. And when I talk to people about this election, actually people of all ages really say they've been watching the TV ads. They're disgusted with them, they don't know who to trust, and they might even stay home. What do you want to tell these young people or all people in that category? What is at stake at this election?
Well, everything is at stake. And the reason I'm running is because I believe we all have to take personal responsibility for the future of our communities and our state and our country. And that's why I'm running, is because I believe if I'm not going to run and try to do the right thing, why should I expect someone else to do that in my place? It's the same reason I served in the military. I mean, there's a lot of people who serve in the military, and I wanted to do my part. And I didn't want to let someone do that in my place. And so in this election, as every election, there's a lot of choices that we need to be making for our future. And if you look at what has made this country great, again, people willing to invest and fight for this country, as I, you know, talked about the greatest generation coming home and investing, this is a clear choice that exists in this election as well, as whether the next 2 years look like the last 2 years, which are of extreme division, of shutting down the government. And that's what my opponent has advocated for. I believe that we need people going to Washington and Congress who want to work together to get the job done. And I believe that there has to be Republicans and Democrats who want to do that. And we can't keep sending back the same failed representative and expect a different result. And so, again, if you want things to change for the next 2 years, if you don't want the next 2 years to look like the last 2 years, then you need to make sure your voice is heard.
Would you vote for a constitutional amendment that would remove the corporation as personhood and thereby invalidate the logic that allows for so much money in politics?
I would. I would. And I've endorsed a lot of different campaign finance reform moves. I think that that's a foundational fix. And when people are complaining about all these TV ads that they are seeing, rightfully so, most of them aren't even being paid for by the candidates themselves. They're being paid for by these outside groups and super PACs. And that is a foundational fix that our democracy needs to ensure that, you know, these elections aren't being decided by these outside groups and billionaires.
Have you seen any ads for you that you don't like?
There haven't been a lot of outside in my, you know, luckily enough in my race here, there hasn't been a lot of outside ads. But I know that there's people, and that's part of the problem, is there may be people who are, you know, considered supporting you who may be running ads that you don't even agree with. And then that gets, you know, you get stuck with that, is you, you know, people are asking you to defend things that you're not even saying. And that's exactly why we need, you know, comprehensive campaign finance reform.
Do you think your ad criticizing Steve King for taking pay raises was a fair ad, or do you think it kind of pushed the limit?
I think it was absolutely a fair ad, and Congressman King even admitted he had disputed that he had voted to raise his own pay. And in the debate last Thursday, he did admit to it and actually said, well, it was a bad bill and I didn't want to. And so he admitted the fact that he was doing that. What my ad pointed out was the hypocrisy that he had voted to raise his own pay while voting against a minimum wage increase. And so his pay had gone up time and time again by $20,000 a year over the time he's been in Congress. Yet during that same time, he'd voted time and time again against raising the minimum wage for 300,000 working Iowans. And if you work 40 hours a week, at minimum wage, you make less than $15,000 a year. And so I was pointing out the hypocrisy that existed there in that he was voting to increase his own pay while voting against a pay increase for working Iowans.
Right, that there's no cost of living increase in the minimum wage.
Exactly. And, of course, you know, he refers to his pay raises as cost of living increases while the minimum wage doesn't receive the same treatment. So that's what I was pointing at. I support a minimum wage increase. He does not, but he does support raising his own pay during that same time.
And that was Jim Maurer, candidate for the U.S. Congress seat in the 4th District. Once again, the Steve King campaign was contacted and offered equal time on our airways. However, all of these arrangements occurred late last week, and the King campaign was not able to make time for us. We will post both candidates' websites on our webpage so that listeners can easily access both candidates' points of view. Moving on now to a candidacy that has not received as much attention, Jonathan Narcisse, Des Moines businessman and former school board member, is running for governor of the state of Iowa on the Iowa party ticket. Mr. Narcisse has been involved in radio and as an advocate for African Americans in the state. Mr. Narcisse, welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you for having us on your public airways. It's important for people to be able to not only be bombarded by political advertising, but actually to have the opportunity to be exposed to solutions when they're being offered. And that's what our campaign is offering, real solutions to the challenges facing Iowans.
Well, thank you. You served on the Des Moines School Board and took a public stance about Iowa education statewide. Can you summarize that work and your positions?
Well, as an education advocate and as a Des Moines School Board member, it's real simple. Iowa's once great education system's in trouble, not just according to me, but 3 years ago on November 1st, Jason Glass, our education chief, one of the few merit hires of the Branstad administration, issued a call to action. The fact is that we have the potential to have a great education system again, but we have to make some tough decisions. As a member of the Des Moines School Board, I was able to make those tough decisions. Even before I got elected, I made a list. There was a list made by a radio host similar to on a show like this of the things I'd get accomplished. Less than 2 years later, despite attempts to remove me from the board and changing the law to shorten my term, every single thing on that list got accomplished. And so I'm proud of that. We still have a lot of work to do.
What sort of things?
Well, for example, we passed a new disciplinary policy. We actually had school board members go public in opposing any kind of new disciplinary policy And yet, after we passed it, it's actually kind of hilarious. If you go back to the tapes, and our meetings are taped, they're taking credit as if they had been working on it for years. But I've told people who've gotten involved in politics, if you're not afraid of hard work, not afraid of criticism, and aren't bothered when other people take credit for what you get accomplished, you can get a great deal done. And so now, as we go into this election tomorrow, first, we're realistic. Barring a miracle of biblical proportion, Governor Branson is going to be reelected. So Iowans are freed from the burden of voting for the lesser of two evils. What they gain by voting for my campaign is a new, unique Iowa party focused on accountability, a party that will hold school boards and city councils and county board of supervisors accountable for the billions and billions of dollars they spend annually of our taxes and the critical decisions they make that shape the lives of our state. Iowans have been spoiled by the presidential beauty pageant called the caucuses, but the impact in the lives of Iowans comes from what their school boards and their city councils and their counties do. And that's where we focus the efforts of the Iowa Party, on local politics, where there really is very little attention paid, and so there's very little accountability that exists.
Okay, so generally local folks are held accountable by this thing called elections, and so if they don't perform well, they get voted out. What is your party proposing to increase that accountability?
That's the way it ought to work. The truth of the matter is that in too many elections, incumbents run unopposed because even at the local level, it's hard to challenge entrenched incumbency. Incumbents often have advantages in who supports their campaign and who gives them checks. We had a bad school board member in Des Moines by the name of Joe Jungleward. He was getting $1,000 checks from people like Jerry Crawford. He had the unions behind him. He had the county cook machine behind him. Now, that won't mean a lot to your listeners, but it would be the equivalent of having the Koch brothers, George Soros, the unions, and the Tea Parties all behind you. He was making bad policy. He was hurting our children. We were able to put together an organized effort that defeated him by a couple dozen votes. That's because it takes organization to challenge entrenched incumbency. At the legislative level, we have close to 50%, if not more, of our legislators running unopposed. They're not doing that good a job. But it's almost impossible in the minds of the citizenry to challenge these. In Polk County, we have six county officials, all Democrats running unopposed. In other counties, we have the same thing with Republicans. They're not doing that good a job. But without big money in politics, people don't know how to take on these incumbents. Well, guess what? Focused, disciplined organization can.
I think you have identified something, you know, that is characteristic of Iowa politics. There is quite a tendency here to keep the incumbent in. I want to keep a little discipline and focus on the questions that I wrote find out some of your points of view on things. You know, I'm interested, actually, really interested in this the disciplinary policy that you mentioned, and you've wanted to opt out of No Child Left Behind. I'm very curious about that. Can you talk a little bit more in detail about, you know, what was that disciplinary measure that got passed that was successful? Or you think is successful,
absolutely. And let me say, we released Faraday, a major education piece, and people can go to our website. So, I mean, we have a lot on education reform, including a 10 key points. But, you know, our school district was plagued with a lot of discipline problems, violence, weapons in the school, teachers living in fear, students living in fear. I had a TV show when I was on the school board, and I had these basic soccer mom types who talked about pulling their kids out of the district because in first and second grade, there were kids threatening to shank the other students. I had teachers on talking about how kids would come to school armed and administrators wouldn't even inform them. And so we were able to bring a lot of pressure to bear. And so there were some key areas. I got about 95% of what I had supported, didn't get 100%. But we were able to get a new structure and policy in place to protect students, to protect teachers. One of my big issues was security. I had talked about the importance of school security long before the shooting in Newton, Connecticut. There was a shooting at Cleveland Tech. Interestingly enough, one of the school board members said, I'm tired of talking about security in schools every time a kid gets shot in America. I was stunned, and it's a matter of public record. And yet, there have been security measures taken since I got on the board. I remember having a parent call me saying, you know what, I used to deliver stuff to the schools and I could walk in and just walk around the building without anyone ever asking me a question. Now I have to check in at the front. Those seem like small things. But, you know, if first of all, most of our offices in Des Moines, you can't just walk in. You can't walk into the TV stations or the radio stations or the newspapers and just wander around the building. You can't walk into the corporate offices. You know, in banks, you have security. And yet in our schools where we have the most precious thing in our lives, our children, they're not protected. If we would have replaced the children in Newton, Connecticut with solid gold bars, and we would have replaced the teachers with diamond-encrusted platinum bars, very few people, if any, would have been killed because we would have had massive security protecting that gold and platinum. But when it's our children, we invest almost nothing in their security.
Okay, well, how about arming teachers? They've talked about that in other states. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a place in between arming teachers and not arming teachers, and that's security. We don't have to arm bank tellers.
Okay.
We don't have to arm. You know, there are a lot of people we don't arm that have security.
Yep.
I'm just saying we don't.
Oh, I agree. I just want to move on. You've been an advocate for African Americans in the state. You've served on a statewide commission for that goal. And for quite a long time, can you tell me what gains you have seen that you feel at least partly responsible for in your role there?
Well, I was appointed to the chair commission on the African Americans by Governor Branstad years ago, and I was also the head of the State of Black Iowa Initiative. Ironically, Jack Hatch was our chief legislative liaison, and the conclusions we reached were that the issues and challenges that faced African Americans in Iowa were very much socioeconomic challenges that many poor whites also faced. When we looked at the disparity in justice, you know, we find high levels of African American incarceration, but the truth is that poor whites were afforded no more justice. Years ago, I was asked to write a piece on the academic crisis facing African Americans by the Register. I said, if you let me write a piece on the white academic crisis, I will, because you know, there are some challenges the black community faces, but a huge part of that's because of the economic disparity. And so I've not only advocated for individuals in the African American community, I've also fought for all Iowans, including you know, our white children. In fact, one of the things that I pointed out from the Jason Glass release 3 years ago and pointed out Saturday is that he talked about how our white students had fallen significantly behind their white peers nationally. Now, that's not too popular. It's not very popular when an African-American says those things, because people like you in nice little boxes. Also, one of the things that I've done in my advocacy is I've challenged individuals in the African-American community. If you go to my website and you see the Martin Luther King speech I gave, I said, you know, there comes a time when you have to stop blaming racism and look in the mirror. You know, when you know, the high level of wedding births that we have in our community is unacceptable. Men need to marry the women they get pregnant. You know, if we can find our way to Prairie Meadows to gamble 20 miles away from the center of Des Moines, and we can find our way three or four blocks to the PTA. So a huge part of my campaign has also been about personal responsibility and personal accountability.
Okay.
And that doesn't just apply to the black community. That applies, I believe, to all Iowans.
I find your point about the economic disparity and its effect on the justice system very interesting. And how have you proposed any measures that would change some of those disparities, or in relation to justice, or what sorts of economic measures are you proposing?
Well, we again propose a number of things, whether it's investing in vocational technical education in the state, investing billions and billions of dollars in construction. Doesn't make sense to spend all that money building stuff like schools and government buildings and roads without ever training our young people for those good paying jobs as welders and electricians. I've talked about shifting from funding urban sprawl. You know, if you want to destroy our rich farmland, we subsidize it with tax credits, tax increment financing, and put in roads and poles and sewers. But if you go into our rural areas or blighted urban areas, whether it's Dunlap or Oldiebold or Marcus or Cumberland, where they already have sidewalks and roads and poles and sewers, you get taxed severely if you invest. That's a backwards policy. So we want to shift that. We've talked about reestablishing a food-based economy. We grow fuel, feed, and meat in this state, and 90% of the food we consume in Iowa is produced outside of Iowa. We want to reestablish our food industry. Now, one of the big areas where economics and justice intersects, we want to end this phony war on drugs in this state. The fact is that if you're someone like Dr. David England, former president of Des Moines Area Community College, who was busted with dope in every room of his house, you get sentenced to community service and expungement. But if you're a poor kid who has a joint, I talked to somebody Saturday night, he had a joint. He got sent to jail, and now he's got these fines that he's got to pay that he's struggling with. And so we want to end this phony war. That would save us a couple hundred millions of dollars by shifting recreational use to the civil docket, where you pay a fine from the criminal docket. And then we also have said, you know what, let's fully legalize marijuana, not just medical marijuana. Medical marijuana is a no-brainer. Doctors should be able to prescribe what will heal their patients, just like my sister's doctor was able to prescribe this medical poison called chemotherapy to her when she had cancer, and she was cured. But we support full legalization, but not by just taxing it, but by first selling growth permits to Iowans, whether they want to grow enough in their basement for their personal use or 5,000 acres for hemp. They pay a fee accordingly to the amount that they're talking about growing. That money would be shared with the local community in which it's grown, the county, and the state. Then we would sell it in state-owned stores like we're used to with liquor, with the state taking 25 to 30% and the grower taking the other 70 to 75%. And that would be, a portion would be used for residential property tax relief, and a portion would be put into mental health services at the county level. And then the state would take the rest. And then we would tax it, and the state would take their tax, the shared revenue, and the growth permit fees that they collected, and they would invest it in rebuilding our roads, our sewers, our infrastructure, cleaning our waterways. And this would be much better than raising the devastating gas tax.
Okay.
Also, it would allow for our hemp industry to be reborn.
Yes. We are running out of time. I want to thank you for suggesting some solutions for the Iowa economy. Your last words, Jonathan Narcisse, candidate for governor from the Iowa Party.
Well, vote Narcisse tomorrow. And if you have questions, call me at 515-770-1218 or check out our website, narcisseforgovernor.com.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, and today we heard my interview with 4th District candidate Jim Maurer, and gubernatorial candidate Jonathan Narcisse. Links to their campaign web pages and those of their competitors will be posted on our webpage, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. We will also post a link to the Story County Auditor's page where you can find your polling place, although with a little bit of difficulty, as we've discovered. Please educate yourself about the candidates and cast an informed ballot tomorrow. Or the engineer this morning is Rick Morrison. Thank you, Rick. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. As always, your participation as listener is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.